Life Podcast of Cinema.
Ta 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 ta! Getting out there fast.
Yeah.
Because we're late.
I left out even the word the.
Indeed. Sorry we're late this week. I had food poisoning on Sunday.
The throw ups.
It was not pleasant. Never try a new Szechuan delivery place unless someone recommends it first. I'm just going to put that out there. Words to live by,
but
I think.
Somebody recommended it to somebody or they wouldn't be in business.
True. And, you know, it averaged like 3.5 stars on Yelp.
3.5 diarrheas.
Maybe I didn't read that correctly. That might have been
what they got.
It was 3.5.
It's the new special diarrhea section.
Brown
of Yelp.
Stars. No. 3.5 brown stars.
And we have a guest.
Yeah.
A returning guest of this program.
Yeah.
Our favorite.
How many returnings have we ever had?
We've had a few. Robert Abel's been on several times.
Manola's been on a couple times.
Drew Drogi.
Drew's been on.
Gray and
twice.
Bibbs.
You're right.
You know, you're in select company.
Right. Well, when I heard that you had Drew on more than once, I was like, fuck that. I've known you for a decade.
Okay, clean podcast.
Oh, really?
Please. Yes.
I swore last time. You told me I could swear last time.
I don't think so. But anyway,
we may have told you you could swear last time, but you got bleeped after the fact.
Yes. So we'll cut it. We'll cut it later.
Ugh.
And we'll actually cut it this time as opposed to last week where I sort of semi-swore and then didn't take it out later. But I vow that it was actually more of a wordplay than an actual swear.
You ruined our clean podcast.
You guys have become the man.
Now we're dirty.
Anyway, our returning guest is one of our favorite horror experts, Sean Abley.
Hi, everybody.
Welcome.
I know you're being a ghost, and that's not an editorial comment on my presence. Thank you.
Sean is the author of...
some dumb book.
Something right. In the Dark. What's your
Out story? In the Dark.
Out in the Dark, oh, thank
God.
You.
Do you have a copy in here somewhere?
I do. I bought you signed one for me.
That's right. Out in the Dark... Interviews with gay horror filmmakers, actors, and authors. Something
yes.
to that effect.
And you got a bunch of really cool ones.
I did, and I'm working on more. Well, the Gay of the Dead blog on Fangoria.com, plug, plug, plug.
And that's still happening?
That's the feeder for the next book.
Awesome.
So, yes.
Good. Yeah. So Halloween be coming up, so we thought we'd have Sean in to talk about horror stuff, and he actually even sat through some of this week's movies on our behalf.
Wait, what did you see? You saw John Wick with me.
Uh-huh,
and you saw Ouija with us.
Ouija with both of us.
Yeah.
What else did you see?
That's it.
You didn't see Birdman yet?
No.
Okay.
I have opinions on a few of the other films that I haven't seen. The reason why I strong-armed you into having me on this month is because I thought there was going to be all these horror movies to see, and there was one.
Yeah.
I mean, you already did Annabelle.
Well, the Horns opens next Friday.
Right.
We'll be talking about that on next week's show.
Well, I wish I was there because I have things to say about Kevin Smith.
No, that's Tusk.
Oh, Tusk, right.
Horns is the Daniel Radcliffe grows devil horns movie.
Right, okay.
Which, as well as...
I love that this is now a genre.
I will discuss this more in detail next week, but I think I liked Horns more than I would have because I had just seen Tusk.
Oh, okay.
Sometimes one movie will do that to you on another movie.
Right.
But, you know.
Now you should eat other Chinese food because now you've got, you'll love it.
No, look, it tasted great. That was the thing. If it had been iffy at all, then I might have known that the Firestorm 2014 was coming. But
everybody out.
All right, here's how it's gonna go.
Uh-huh.
You're gonna start talking about Ouija.
Okay.
I'm going to put my headphones down and check the pot on the stove.
Okay.
But I'll be back in 10 seconds. The listeners will not even know that I abandoned them.
And they probably wouldn't have if you hadn't have announced all this.
But I have to, it's like I have to.
You're keeping it real.
I have to say what is, look, if I got up in the middle of you talking about Ouija, you'd be like, what are you doing? Sit down.
We should have a complex series of symbols. It means walking over to check pot on stove back in 10 seconds. But we do not.
Begin talking about... Wait, did we even introduce you
we
and
have
me
not.
Yet?
All no, right. I'm...
Linoleum Knife, this is the podcast of the cinema. I'm Dave White of Movies.com. You're Alonzo Duralde of The Rap and What the Flick. The end.
Boom.
Ouija!
Okay, so...
Where's Dave going? I don't understand. What?
So, I guess I never thought that, realized that Ouija is a Hasbro product.
Me neither.
I always thought it was sort of generic, like Chinese checkers or something.
Or the devil's tool. I mean, honestly, there's a whole segment of the population that's like, don't touch that.
Exactly. Who knew there was a trademark on the occult? But yeah, so it's a Hasbro product, which means this is a Hasbro movie, which means Michael Bay is an executive producer on it. And so it's about how you shouldn't get a Ouija board because it will open the gates of hell. Brought to you by the people who want to sell you a Ouija board. Ta-da! It's a PG.
I'm back, and I decree that to be extremely metal.
To make a movie to sell a product by showing it as being dangerous?
To make a movie about your own thing, to tell the world that every preacher you ever met in your life was right, that your simple, innocent toy is the thing that will bring ghosts, devils, and death Final Destination style.
I think the next Hasbro movie will be called Choking Hazard.
And why don't you go out and buy one right now?
Exactly.
Because you know you're gonna.
Doesn't this make Ouija boards look awesome, even though it makes them look terrible?
I feel like that's a little more Saturday Night Live, or first 5 years for me, where they were always like bringing the cast of real life into like the sketches and things, and you know, I don't know. I didn't really have anywhere else to go for that.
That's what I felt. Or you were referring to like, you know, Johnny Bag of Glass or whatever. Right. Irwin Mainways,
yes. Or Johnny the Invisible Pedestrian.
Right. I didn't hate this movie.
Me neither.
It's
victory.
It's dumb, but I had a good time.
Yeah, like it's not, you know, it's not scary or smart, but keep talking. I don't want to dominate you or anything.
No, heavens, no. It is a solid tween horror movie, you know, and given how lame-o so many PG-13 movies are with nothing up their sleeves but the jump scare, this one at least, after giving us quite a few of those for the first third or so, dug into some more interesting territory and some kind of like stuff that was gross without being R-rated gory.
Yeah. I have to say, considering the conversation you guys were having with your fellow horrible critics at the screening, where you were all turning your nose up at this crappy horror movie we have to sit through.
Attention studios,
preconceived notions of films that you're giving them free tickets to. I was all ready to be like, count how many times you were scared because I was sitting next to you and you were jumping every time something came out.
I'm easy. The mark.
And I was going to wield that over you. But then you're like, no, I kind of liked it. I enjoyed it. But you're right. It's not scary at all. But as I said, it's like a decent episode of
Are You Afraid of the
Goosebumps?
Dark?
Or what was that one? Tales from the Dark Side. It was one of those like so super cheapy like anthology series.
Those syndicated ones?
Yes. I mean, it was, you know, because it was on two sets, and which is all. So this is a Blumhouse film too. So
right.
You know it's a Blumhouse film because there's the occult. There's one main set.
And there's Lynn Shay.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Who's buying a new house with her and she's great in this film.
She is.
She poor Lynn Shay. Every movie she's in, she has to deliver the lore. Like she literally has to tell you why things are happening with a straight face. I remember Insidious.
Yeah.
Where she has to like go on and on about.
Hi, I'm Beatrice Straight from Poltergeist.
Poor kid. But she does it. She's so good. It's always comforting to see.
Well, one of my favorite gags in the Austin Powers series is the fact that Michael York's character is Basil Exposition.
Right.
She is Basil Exposition.
Yes. I liked it. I liked the people in it for the most part. The girls I think were better than the boys. The main girl, Olivia Cooke, is that her name?
Yeah, she's on Bates Motel.
Yeah, I like her.
Cook with an E.
So she's British. She has an accent.
Yes.
She is British.
British or something.
Yeah, it's funny. Like when I write these reviews a lot, like I'll go on the IMDb page or I'll go through the press kit and I'll list a major credit for actors if they aren't like a household name. Mm-hmm. And everybody in this movie is a teen household name. Like they're like the blonde
girl. Are they household names though? They're just on
They're affiliated with popular shit. Well, okay. Yeah. The boyfriend of the heroine is like the male lead of Secret Life of the American Teenager.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
The blonde girl who dies at the very beginning of the movie.
Spoiler.
No, it's before the credits. Doesn't count as a spoiler. Right. It's the initiating incident or whatever. The inciting incident. Mm-hmm. She is on Teen Wolf.
Yeah.
One of the boys was on Big Love, which is not so much a teen show, but anyway, like they're all they've all got their like you know basic cable bona fides basically. Yeah, so I you know I can't hate this movie. I thought it was it fulfilled its purpose in life. You know,
yeah,
it's for
it will be a sleepover favorite.
Yeah, it's for slumber parties and it's for children,
just like the Ouija board.
You're not if you're an adult who has seen a horror film, you don't need to see this one. It steals from every recent horror film, and then you know dilutes it for kids, and
watching the TV edit of Halloween.
I would dislike that, and I would be unhappy about that if it weren't sort of holding together on its own sort of kid horror merits.
Right.
And it's clearly aimed at that audience. I mean, it's aimed. It's one of those deals where it's aimed at the audience that are younger than the characters in the film.
You know? I was not scared one time. I jumped once because how they cheat with some of these jump scares, where no one should be behind the door in the dark. That person in real life would be like, "Hey, you guys, I can hear you, and here I am in the house." And you know, he wouldn't emerge from the darkness all. Shocking, you know. But then after when that happened, I thought, okay, so you're not going to play fair. This film is not going to play fair. It's because all it has is jump scares because it's for children. So
but it has later. I think it gets to some
people do die. They die on camera.
They do die, yep.
And it makes dental floss real creepy.
Right,
a strange anti-floss message.
Yes.
Right, and that death scene. Really, like, that one actually got to me, because it wasn't the flossing, but it was how, are we allowed to spoil how people die? I mean, is this like...
At this point, does anyone care? We're 3 or 4 days into the release.
Right. The one where the girl floats, and then whatever force drops her, and she hits her face on the sink.
That was good.
The sound effect.
Yeah. Was like, clunk. And there's some blood there, too. I mean, that was creepy.
It's violent enough.
Exactly.
For kids.
Let's go back and talk about what happened before the movie started.
Okay.
That you were so aghast.
First, I think everybody needs to know that I'm not a critic.
Yes.
I go to these screenings with you guys and your horrible critic friends. Yeah. And you all like are like S-talking, because I can't say a bad word, like films and it's all inside baseball and stuff like that. So you guys and Robert Abley and... who was the... I'm sorry, she's going to kill me if... because I talked to them after the film.
Rachel. Yes, our guest from a couple weeks ago.
Yes, we're there, and you're all rolling your eyes so hard, they're like coming out of the back of your heads about how bad this film was going
to
be.
No, I try to give everything the benefit of the doubt, and this movie, frankly, there were a lot of red flags. and you could argue that my going in with such lowered expectations was probably what led to me giving it a decent review. I don't know.
Oh, I could argue that.
I just want to make it very clear that we were all rolling our eyes about what we were expecting to get from this film. Mm-hmm. And that is a very normal thing that happens. Anyone who thinks... and I know you don't think this, but I always feel like this
you
should be...
You always have to defend film critics when I... S-talk them.
No, I
appreciate.
I'm not defending film critics. I'm saying
that... It has to be another one of those peanut butter eyeballs.
That there are people who believe that film critics walk into a film...
Thank you.
Sorry.
Why don't you just eat a bag of chips on the microphone while you're at it?
Because chips aren't chocolate.
These are silent. No one's going to hear me.
Oh, that was a silentest bag...
That's the eating part is what I mean. If you hear the bag, that's just, you know, local color.
Let's stop the show while Alonzo eats the peanut butter cuppy thing. We do not walk in pre-hating. We do walk in often if there are those red flags that he was just talking about.
We've been burned before.
We've been burned before. We do walk in with an amount of trepidation and... our guard up a little bit. Like, what do you got? PG-13
I can name you,
horror film.
I can name you two movies that I gave rave reviews to. I'm sorry.
Who's dominating?
Can I get another 3 stars?
Please finish.
Yeah. Who's the domineering
now? How do you like it now? I can taste your own medicine, Dominator.
But there are people who believe that film criticism should be objective. And there should be... sort of, you know, purity
going an empirical in. Scale. Mm-hmm.
But human beings are film critics, and that cannot be. There is no such thing as objectivity in criticism. Good writing of any sort is from the person, and people are subjective.
Right.
And so, you know, and this has been shown to be true in conversations I've had with other film critics who have openly confessed to me they dislike certain genres of film. Specifically, and most of the time,
horror films. Yeah.
Yeah. This is, and I've discussed this, I've told this story once before on the show, but very quickly I will recap it. The day I was in a screening, not a horror movie, but the subject of Hostel came up, and four or five different film critics around me, and there were only that many people in the screening room, were sort of decrying films like Hostel, and they were throwing around the torture porn word, words that was so popular at that moment.
Snooze.
And, exactly. And I stayed silent. And then one of them, who knew me well, better than the others, said, wait a second, you like those kinds of movies? And I said, yes, I do. And they said, well, why? And at this point, the conversation had stopped, and they all turned to me, and I said, because I like to watch people get their heads chopped off. And then they stopped talking. And so, you know, I love horror, but I did walk into Ouija thinking, it's PG-13. And it's based on a board game. And the board game is not... Here was my big...
The board game was less of a plot than Cluedo. Right.
What Rachel said before, and we all agreed with her because we were all thinking the same thing, is you knew the board game was not going to be the villain. We knew that going in. The board game was not going to be the villain. And then guess what? The board game was the villain!
Yeah. I thought, that like, how bad are they going to make a Ouija board look if they're trying to sell Ouija boards?
That was a nice surprise.
Apparently not an issue.
Yeah.
I feel like... and I'm going to cop to this when we get to
They were negging you to make you desire them.
I have preconceived notions about another film we're going to talk about today, and also about this one. And I will accuse you later of the same thing that I will cop to myself, cherry picking, because this is a genre that I love. Like, I love this genre, so I'm like looking for reasons for it to be good.
Well, I'm not a big horror person, and maybe that makes me the target for this movie because I'm not a horror person. But I had a good time. But no, I can actually name three recent examples of movies that I went to with like just thinking, ugh, and loved it.
Yeah,
The Conjuring.
I liked it.
I really enjoyed that film, and I thought it looked so dumb and just typical Ooga Booga haunted house stuff.
It's the best of the James Wan films, I have to say,
for sure. The Three Stooges.
I love the Three Stooges. I thought it was going to be horrible.
Who thought that was a good idea? No one. And it's great.
I want them to do another one. It was so funny.
Oh, yeah. Totally. And I've brought this one up occasionally, too, on the show. Mr. Megorium's Wonder Emporium had the worst trailers, and I just thought, ugh. And I wept at the end of that movie.
Wow.
So, you know, yeah, I am always open to surprise, even if I have a bit of a, like, you know, bad feeling about something just based on surface, you know.
I thought that about Dumb and Dumber. I went to see Dumb and Dumber thinking I was going to hate it, and I love it.
I hope the sequel's
Dumb and Dumber is really funny.
Oh, it's so funny when he hits her in the face with that snowball. And Jeff Daniels taking that big, can I say, dump?
BM.
Yeah. Right. I'm like, you're Jeff Daniels. You've been nominated for Academy Awards. What are you doing?
All right, moving on. I did not see John Wick, but you guys sure did.
Hey, Sean, why don't you tell everybody what John Wick is about?
Oh, man, I feel like I'm the lone voice in, like, because
that's
again,
why I want you to tell everybody what John Wick is about.
We went to it together, again, at a critics screening. And
yes.
We sat around with all the critics around me, and I was on my phone listening and not talking. And then we got out, and I thought, okay, great. Everybody's going to hate this movie as much as I did, because I thought John Wick was garbage. And everybody stood up and was like, that was great! I'm like, have you all lost your minds? Like, people that I respect, you know, opinions of whom opinions I respect were just like, that was great!
Tell people what it's about.
It is about Keanu Reeves plays an ex- although, can you ever really be an ex-hitman?
Nope.
Who had a change of heart because he met a girl, and he gave it all up, and then she died, and now they're dragging him back in. And so then so that's basically the setup for 90 to 100 minutes.
You're leaving out the puppy.
Well, Okay, I was going to get to that when I talk about why I didn't like it, but it's like 100 minutes of people getting shot in the face. 90. Which I love. I love people getting shot in the face.
Who doesn't?
Dumb people. But, yes, yeah, so this whole movie is kicked off by bad people, and you know they're bad because A, they have Russian accents, and B, they play rap music loud in their car, killing John Wick's puppy. And you know his name is John Wick because it's said about 5,000 times in the movie. He has a two-name.
Yep, he's the Dave White of
exactly.
John Wick's.
Yeah. And they kill his puppy because somehow his wife, before she died, set up this posthumous delivery of a puppy to him.
That's an incredible service.
With an, I know.
Death puppies.
Death puppy with a note that she apparently hand wrote and gave to them and like, hold on to this until I die. And then he got it. It's like, love this as much as you love me. And he's like, okay. And then it's like the best house trained puppy ever because it doesn't like poop in the house.
It already knows. It already knows right. to want to go outside.
It's basically a robot dog.
When your owner has a gun, you right. know, you're more likely
That's
to.
That's true. And
I'm your puppy. Don't kill me, John Wick.
Yeah. And the bad people see John Wick in his nice car with the puppy, and they're like, we want your car and your puppy. And he's like, no, thanks. And they're like, okay, now you've done it. And then it's killing the puppy and stealing the car, and because John Wick is an ex-hitman, and there's rules to these things.
But they didn't know it was him. They didn't know
right,
who he was.
Right.
They were the sons. They were the son of the big boss yeah. and the son's stupid friends.
Yeah. And he's such yeah. a famous, amazing hitman that they didn't know who he was. And yeah. so... I don't know. And then it's
kids just, got no respect.
Right. And then it's shooting in the face for, you know, 90 minutes, and I wonder how it turns out. Gosh, what's the ending to this film? I can't even imagine.
Well, yeah. if it were a superhero movie, the puppy wouldn't die.
That too. I actually was surprised they did kill the puppy, which, of course, as much like, what's that film? Inside Llewyn Davis. Immediately set, like, there was cat danger in that film, and I hated that movie, and there's, like, puppy... danger in this film, and I hate this film. I don't know, maybe that's it. Maybe
it's not just puppy danger, it's puppy
dead.
Puppy murder.
Murder.
In soft focus, thank God.
Puppy, yeah. puppy side.
Yeah. But then you see its dead body, and it's, yeah. I just
you
think
do see its dead body, and that was a lot for me.
Yeah.
Like, when I saw it, it was like, oh. Oh,
and there's a sound effect.
Poor little puppy.
Maybe it's meant as a direct response to that screenwriting guide, Save the Cat.
Save the Cat.
It's an adorable puppy.
It's a
too.
Beagle. It's
She's
like
a baby little beagle girl puppy.
Yeah.
And you're immediately like, I mean, seriously, the audience in the 5 to 7 minutes that we actually get to have the puppy with us, mm-hmm. the audience, every time the puppy does something, everyone was going, oh.
Cuter than the dog in The Drop?
The same.
Okay.
The same cuteness. As the dog in the
neighbor,
drop.
Your neighbor's dog is barking.
I don't love that.
It's chiming in.
That happens. Reviews.
Maybe you're living above an assassin.
That happens every time we do this show, and every time we eat breakfast, and every time we watch a TV show, and every time
we walk in front of the
we
door.
We walk anywhere.
And don't do anything to that dog, because you could set up a chain of events that
I
you will regret.
I'm just guessing that these dogs downstairs, that their owners...
are not hitmen.
Aren't badass hitmen.
Yeah.
Nor are they people who bother to train their dogs.
Mm-hmm. No.
Dogs, but that's another story.
Dogs bark. So to sum up, because I don't want to take up too much time
some
talking about this garbage
dogs bark more
film.
Than others.
Dogs' mothers are bigger than
yeah.
This movie was bereft of an original idea, and Keanu Reeves is awful. He can't, literally cannot say a two-word sentence realistically.
I would like the audience to know that I'm nodding my head yes to the things that Sean Abley is saying.
David, I'm sure, is going to explain why this doesn't matter to him in a moment. There's no original ideas in it. It's just, you know, Keanu Reeves is a hitman because they say he is, because the filmmakers say he is. He's an expert at, like, fighting because they gave him a stunt coordinator, and they gave him a suit, and they gave him hair and makeup, and it's just, they're all wearing him. All that stuff is wearing him, sorry. And, oh my gosh, you have to mark down the time because
yes.
I just swore. There's nothing. There's nothing about this that makes it original or smart. It's insulting that they spend this much money on a movie that they're now going to force down our throats. And I have to say, there is definitely a part of me that is so dismayed that people like it. I was trying to convince Dave on the way home how to review this film. And when he was telling me how he's going to review this film, I'm like, I'm disappointed in you. Like, I was trying to make him agree with me. And
your disappointment in me means nothing.
I know, because it's ongoing, quite honestly.
Yes.
But anyway, so that is it. I don't get it. And I went in with preconceived notions that I wasn't going to like it. And they were fulfilled. And the end. But it was free!
An absolutely non-essential movie that did not need to be made. So, yes, agree. Mm-hmm. An original idea in the movie? No. Keanu Reeves, good actor? I don't think so. I think that he has been good in some films. Most of them have been comedies.
Three films. I think we talked about this, right?
You said three films. Yep. I think more than
Bill and Ted, Parenthood. The Matrix.
I'd have to go back to his IMDb page to
only
get...
Only one of the Bill and Ted?
To get a list for myself.
There was nothing... I mean, the second Bill and Ted was sort of...
Oh, I like the second one better.
No,
in terms of his dramatic abilities, I think of him as sort of a Zelig kind of thing, where...
Wow.
Where he conforms to the atmosphere of the film he's in. Like, the film sort of gives him his personality. He doesn't bring anything to a dramatic role because every word out of his mouth sounds like a kid trying to sound like an adult on the phone.
So Christian Bale's Batman.
Yeah. And so I am fine with him fulfilling that role in cinema history. Like, he is... He is the actor that we have in this generation who simply takes the shape of the vessel he's poured into.
Yeah.
And the movie says he's angry, therefore Keanu is angry. The movie says he's a badass hitman, therefore he is a badass hitman. Mm-hmm. The thing he does bring to it is an association with these co-directors who have been his stuntmen for quite some time and who have worked with him on various projects. And so they know how his body moves and how to make it look like he's doing a lot more than he actually is. Mm-hmm. And so, also because they're stuntmen, they gave me the biggest pleasure that I had in the film, which was, aside from all the faces being blown off or stabbed, which is always fun.
Yes.
I loved the absolutely unrealistic, fantastical, ballet-style world of the underground crime hitman community,
yes,
where there are hitman hotels where they whisk you in and clean up your messes. There are hitman doctors who are on call 24/7 who will come in and stitch up your stuff and perform hitman hotel room surgery upon you.
Yeah.
There are cleanup crews that all you have to do is call them on the phone and be like, I'd like to make a dinner reservation. And then they come in and they...
It's Harvey Keitel.
And it's spotless when they're done. And like everything is as though no one had been there. And it really is to me like how a few weeks ago...
So there's a whole hitman-based economy.
Shannon gave us her kick-ass tickets to see Swan Lake a few weeks ago at the ballet. And you could just imagine all these people waiting in the wings to come in and sort of do their little choreographed routine to provide the hitman world for Keanu. And then they kind of, whoosh, they're right back out again after they do their little, like,
four-girl pirouette,
and then they're done.
Plié,
and go into that. I was super into how sort of obsequious everyone is in his presence. The cops show up. Heard there was a noise complaint. The cop sees the dead body. And Keanu goes, no, there's no problem. And the cop goes, yeah, I didn't think so.
I think he actually says, I'm just handling some stuff. Or something
like
that.
Yeah, something like that. And the cop's like, anything you say, Mr. John Wick. Like, so that level of crazy artifice, I was really happily into. And I had a wonderful time in this utterly falsely constructed world.
I feel like the film doesn't live up to that because I love that kind of movie. I love that kind of world where they've created this, you know, shadow world that we don't know that sort of happens. But
the Twilight demimonde.
Yeah, but it doesn't live up to that. And I feel like it's presenting it as if it were real. And the only way I think you can get away with those things is if you present it and it's like Earth 2. Like, you know, there's...
stylized.
Right. There's another dimension where this sort of exists.
It has to be almost Wes Anderson-like, yeah, where everything is just sort of like... The eyebrows are arched,
right, too, you know,
hyper, yeah.
Yes, yeah. The color blasted and all that stuff or what have you. And I just thought that it was that because they decided it was going to be that, and the art director could do that, and the cinematographer could light it that way. But at the end of the day, it didn't deliver any ideas to make me enjoy that.
Right.
So, but again, I am in the minority. I've been reading these rave reviews for this movie, and I don't get it.
When do you begin discussing Birdman, Alonzo?
Okay.
Because you and I have now finally both seen Birdman.
Dave has caught up.
My review will eventually run on movies.com. Currently, my Ouija review is up on movies.com.
Oh, hooray.
Birdman is not. John Wick is not.
Oh, yeah.
Someday, some sweet day, my employer is going to decide, oh, yeah, we have a film critic who writes for us. Let's put his reviews up. They've been up there. They've been ready for a week.
The movie's almost on DVD now.
Do you hear that? Helicopter? It's that shadow world.
My employer is coming to arrest me for...
It's the shadow world of critics. They have critic theaters and the critic hotels where they're constantly giving things thumbs up and thumbs down. Right,
they're called
stars.
Film festivals. Yes. Okay, so Birdman, or The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance is the full title. New film from Alejandro González Iñárritu.
Nice.
Thank you.
Nice Spanish talking there from you. How did you come by that?
Shush. Whose previous films I have not cared for.
Me neither.
Yes, but in this one, he actually has a sense of humor for once. Michael Keaton stars as...
Okay, yeah, you go keep...
Can I get up and get a drink while you do this?
Sure.
I don't know.
I feel like I need to announce that, too, because
that's
the press announcement said...
Just make sure you take your headphones off.
All right.
Michael Keaton stars as a somewhat washed-up Hollywood actor, best known for playing a superhero, who is now starring in, directing, and adapting a Broadway show based on Raymond Carver's What We Talk About When We Talk About Love. It is the last couple of days before the first performance, and it being backstage at a trouble-plagued Broadway show, it's pandemonium, and actors are getting hit by falling lights and being replaced by, you know, last-minute divas played by Ed Norton. The Keaton character's girlfriend announces that she's pregnant. His daughter, Emma Stone, who is fresh out of rehab, is trying to keep things together. And all the while, Keaton's character is hearing messages from the Birdman character, who's telling him that he needs to knock it off with the art and go back to making apocalyptic pornography. And the movie is shot by the great Emmanuel Lubezki, and in a way that suggests that there are no edits, which of course there are, but scenes go on, and the camera is moving all the way through this theater and doing really complicated stuff without any apparent edits, and so the actors are sort of called upon to do these long takes, and there's this percussive jazz score underneath to really kind of underscore the tension and mania of what's going on. I really enjoyed this film.
Is it my turn?
Yes.
Okay. I maybe enjoyed it a little less than you, but I did think it is very good.
Uh-huh.
I think that... say his name in Spanish for me again one more time.
Alejandro González Iñárritu.
Thank you. I think he is still as literal-minded as ever. And not as in touch with his sense of humor as we would like to hope. And certainly still as showy and ostentatious as he has ever been.
Sure.
Or else he wouldn't have had Lubezki
shoot it that way.
Bend over backwards to make it look all tricked out like it does.
Like rope.
But I think it's a step in the right direction. For him, and I am I'm happy with it, even though I don't think it tells us anything new about the lives of creative people or about the idea that that when you become really, really, really successful for whatever your art happens to be,
mm-hmm.
that people begin to think that they have some kind of ownership over you. And I mean, we've experienced this in the past week with Renee Zellweger's face.
Oh, do we get to talk about that?
Where we think we own her somehow. And right. that what she does with her body is somehow open for our input. And so what you get in this film is Keaton's character betraying his audience, and you can feel that when the crowd, when the people on the street come up to him to be fannish to him, they're very demanding of him. They demand pictures. They demand autographs. They kiss him without his consent. They tell him, "You suck," even after they ask him for the autograph.
Well, they take the picture and then they say, "You suck."
They take the picture and say, "You suck." So they own him, and they feel betrayed by him because he did the thing you're not supposed to do. He walked away from the mass...
From the hit franchise.
From the hit franchise that appeals to the mass group of people.
Right.
And he did it a long time ago, and that simmering resentment that he didn't stay famous for them is there. And then you also have this really hilariously, cartoonishly hateful theater critic.
I was going to bring her up, yes.
Who...
has already decided, unseen, that she's going to torpedo this whole
And she tells him as much. I am going to destroy your play, she says.
Yeah.
And I think that's really crazy and really funny, too.
I think
it's about the idea that we somehow get to tell celebrities what they can and cannot do,
right.
Who they should and should not be, when they have... partially through their own fault by chasing whatever that level of fame, but also simply by being of the predisposition to become a creative, you know, person in the world, to be an actor, to be a filmmaker, to be an artist, to be a writer, to do whatever, that if they, through sheer luck or the secret or whatever it is they get, however it is they get there, that somehow now... They should then live in cages for us to poke.
Right.
And it's the reason why, and you and I have this discussion all the time, when we see like a character actor or something out in the world where we think we're really into what they do, you're willing to go up to that person and say, "Hey, I thought that movie you did with blah blah 2 years ago that nobody saw was fantastic." Mm-hmm. On one level, I agree with you that that's a nice thing to do. You've given them a nice day. Mm-hmm. I don't want to ever talk to anybody, period. And I feel like I should never, ever, 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 no matter who it is, no matter if it's the woman who played the mom in My So-Called Life that I saw in an elevator one day, I don't want, and I can't even remember her name, Bess
Armstrong?
Bess Armstrong.
Yeah. Oh, she's the greatest.
Bess Armstrong. I saw her in an elevator one day, and she was the mom in My So-Called Life, and I thought, "Hey, you're the mom in My So-Called Life." And I thought, I should tell her how great My So-Called Life is. And then I thought, no. I don't know her.
The longer we live here, the less inclined I am to make that connection. But I only, again, just so we're clear on this, I only ever talk to people who I don't think get recognized.
No, I'm not saying that you go and behave horribly to celebrities.
I chase them down.
In your car.
Yeah.
No, I chased down Tyra Banks. Yeah,
we know what you did to Jane Sibbery.
Tyra Banks.
I know the Jane Sibbery story.
I'm trying to think of the other people who I've been stupid to. And, Peter Weller.
You terrified Jane Sibbery. Yeah. So I like that this movie is about that. I don't think it has anything to say original about the subject other than be nice to people and leave them alone. And I do believe that the Raymond Carver story, what we talk about when we talk about love, is sort of shot through this whole film. You know, the idea of what does it mean to love art? What does it mean to love an artist? What does it mean to, like, take care of each other? The father and daughter relationship in the film with Emma Stone. You know, what does it mean to love your family?
Yeah, the ex-wife stuff, played by Amy Ryan.
There's no real... new here, but no, I like the way it presents what it presents.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's a groundbreaking film, but I found it an exhilarating experience, and I found it really entertaining.
I really dig Keaton here.
Yeah, no, he's true.
I like how he's all over the place, He's everywhere in this movie.
Yeah, he gets to do a lot of stuff. He gets to do all kinds of stuff. He commits to everything. Yeah. And no, I really enjoyed that. And the whole thing with the critic character, I kind of feel like when artists bag on critics, that it's telling you more about the artist than it is about critics.
Well, oh, stop it.
No, I'm serious.
Oh, stop
I'm
it.
Serious. I think when you make these really two-dimensional, like, baddie critics that are just out to get you, that tells me more about the artist than it does about the nature of criticism. Because I know critics, and the thing is, it's like, I always get the, you know, the complaint from people, well, you hate movies. Why do you even do this? It's like, no, I like movies. I like movies more than you do.
There's
which
a question.
Is why when you can see a crappy movie and be like, oh, well, that was all right for 90 minutes, and I get mad about it because I care about movies. They
Here's
mean
the very easy
me.
Answer. Very easy answer to the question that Michael Keaton actually says to the hateful film critic and the hateful theater critic in the movie. Mm. He says, what has to happen in a person's life for them to become a critic? And the answer is this. The person decides they want to be a writer. And then the person decides that they need to write about something they love.
And the kind of writer they want to be.
And the kind of writer they want to be.
Ideally. Well, here, I feel like this
I don't know any film critics that are... That fit the mold, the cliche of
right.
frustrated filmmaker.
No.
They all wanted to be critics.
But I have 2 points on this subject. One, this is much like when you see journalists talking about criticism of journalism. Like when you see newscasters talking about like documentaries, like criticizing the news. Yes. And then it's like, that's never happened. I don't know who they're talking to. So I'm going to dilute your guys' arguments by about 50% for that. But the second thing is, I don't think it's not that film critics are frustrated filmmakers. Because I get it. Like, there's different forms of, like, writing and art and things like that, and film criticism can be an art. But I also feel like there is a type of film critic that wants to save the world from bad films, and therefore their taste in film is somewhat absolute. Because if they think a film is bad and they want to save the world from it, they're telling the people that they need the audience needs to have the film critic's taste in film.
Oh, that's
me. And I see that, and I feel like that is
absolutely
that
me.
Is as opposed to film journalism or film like you know I don't know what examination.
But I think
it becomes an ego-driven thing.
But I think that's as valid a style of criticism because it's so subjective. I don't think we all have to be consumer reporters. That we all have to say, well, if you like X, Y, and Z, then you'll like this. You can say, this movie offended me on these levels, you know. And look, I'm sure that at this point I have a readership that strictly reads me because they know if I like something, they'll hate it, and vice versa. Right. So I think the key is you read a critic enough to know what pushes their buttons, what things they appeal to them and what don't.
Right.
And yeah, they are allowed that absolutism because that's because criticism is, there is no subjective place of criticism. It's all about your own experience and
your
own
objective.
Place. Objective, sorry. Yeah. It's all subjective. It's all about your own experiences and your own right. filters and your own likes and dislikes.
But I think motivation has a big part to do with it. And like, what was that documentary about Broadway? It was about the season of Broadway.
Oh yeah, opening the one with
it was
the
like,
Wicked and
right and like
yeah. Avenue Q
and Avenue Q is yeah. all opening at the same time. And there's that one critic, I wish I knew his name, who's just a horrible person. And he sort of revels in being a horrible person. And his sort of agenda is to be the horrible, like the mean film critic. And
it's a Broadway critic.
It's a Broadway critic.
Oh, okay.
Broadway.
But they
Broadway.
Seem to have a lot of
and
power.
And he's literally
still,
like
right?
sitting, don't you know, they? Twittering his fingers. Well, theater criticism is sort of a different beast than film.
Don't
criticism.
Those theater critics have a lot more power? Than film
well,
critics.
In New York, yeah,
because plays run and they don't necessarily have to be done. So theater
yeah.
criticism can actually be taken as constructive notes if they're meant constructively and possibly incorporated. Whereas film criticism, the film is done,
right?
So you're basically like you know you're
yeah.
you're criticizing or
a thing that
a
exists
picture.
That cannot be changed.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Anyway, so I feel like. You know, there obviously there's a lot of critics there, pure of heart, and then there's the Rex Reeds of the world. Sorry, Rex Reed. If you're personal friends with him, I'm sorry, but you know who's.
Oh, just say the name. He's a crazy old person.
Right.
That's, I mean,
well, yeah,
and old is not the pejorative here.
No.
He's
crazy, and he doesn't necessarily see the films.
Like
his staff sees the films for him, and it's just that is that unfortunately paints you guys with that brush.
Well, here's,
to people like me.
Like here's the thing that I always throw out as my defense about having like personal vendettas or whatever. I have made no secret of the fact that like I had a horrible, horrible, horrible encounter with Tommy Lee Jones in a professional circumstance.
Yeah.
And I have given him good reviews since then. Even though I would like step out of a subway car if he stepped onto it. Like, I don't want to be anywhere near him ever again in my life. But, you know, I see him in Lincoln. I see him in Hope Springs. I'm like, stop making me like you on Tommy Lee Jones. You're really good in this.
It's sort of like when you said nice things about my play.
For instance, yes, that was, oh.
It pains you.
That hurt me inside.
It's like having my spleen taken out through my navel. Sean's play, Bitches, right. which he wrote and directed and appears in, is running for one more weekend.
Yes, one more weekend.
At the Actors...
Acting Artists Theater in West Hollywood.
And where can people get
at the
tickets?
Acting Box.
Yes. Black Box Theater. Brown paper tickets.
Yes.
Honestly, if you type in Bitches by Sean Abley, the ticket site will come up because there aren't many other.
So yeah, the one weekend left. Dave and I went last weekend, laughed a great deal, and you should totally go.
Yeah.
So there were a couple movies that I saw.
There are three.
Whoa. I'll be quick.
Wait, he's the only one who's
would
seen
you
them?
Like yes. to would you like to hang back on Force Majeure until
sure,
because
that opens here on Friday.
All right.
It opened in New York last
week.
So
talk about Tale of Princess Kaguya, which I am going to see.
Okay.
And talk about Citizen Four.
Sure. All right. Tale of Princess Kaguya, real quick, is Studio Ghibli. It's the new film from Isao Takahata, who's I put right up there with Miyazaki. He directed Pompoko. He directed Grave of the Fireflies.
My Golden Balls.
And My Neighbors, the Yamadas. I am a big fan of his. And
that's the best line from Pompoko.
This movie is exquisitely gorgeous. It's all done in that kind of watercolor style. And it looks hand-drawn. I don't know the intel about how it got done, but it has the feel of a very kind of old school hand-drawn animation. It's based on a Japanese myth, and I suspect that a working knowledge of Japanese folklore will help a lot in this movie, because I frankly wasn't entirely always sure what it was about or what the point of certain things were, but it was just so gorgeous that I could just kind of go with it on that level, and it was totally fine.
Did you see it with American voices, or did you see it with subtitles?
I saw it dubbed, because usually with the Ghibli movies, like they're showing it here, the daytime screenings are dubbed, and then at night is subbed. I like to see it dubbed the first time, because then that way I can take in the whole visual palette of the screen, and then if I have time to see it a second time, I'll go see it with the original Japanese voices, and then with the subtitles on the screen. So I went to the dubbed version, and it's a terrific cast. Chloe Grace Moretz, Darren Criss, Mary Steenburgen, James Caan, and Lucy Liu. And James Caan plays an old bamboo cutter, and one day in the woods, a tree blossoms, and in the center of it is the teeny tiny princess who he takes home. And as soon as he hands her over to his wife, played by Mary Steenburgen, she suddenly like becomes the size of an infant. And over the course of a very short time, like blossoms into womanhood. And then on a separate excursion to the forest...
Does she ever become a giantess?
She does not.
Oh. Is this the Timothy Green story?
Not exactly. So while she is sort of growing and running around with this gang of local kids in the mountains in the country and, like, you know, finding animals and plants and you know, becoming one with nature, James Caan discovers another tree that is filled with gold, and he decides that because heaven has sent him this child and now all this gold, that clearly they need to move to the city where he can buy a big mansion and set her up as a princess and marry into nobility. So he takes her away to the city to do all that, and hires Lucy Liu to come in to teach her how to be a woman. It's all about, you don't laugh, you don't do this, you don't do that, you shave off your eyebrows, you blacken your teeth. You
what?
Know, yeah, well, that's women, the nobility, they didn't, you know, need that stuff.
They blackened their teeth?
They blackened their teeth because they kept their mouths closed.
Weird.
Yeah. And so I was thinking, okay, so this is about misunderstanding the gifts of heaven, or this is about the raw deal that women got in the feudal era? I don't know. And then it goes off in interesting directions, but I it's hard to explain what this movie's about. And again, I think if I had more of a working knowledge of Japanese folklore, I would have nailed it more. But just as a thing to look at, it is gorgeous. And so I very much recommend it on that front. And if you want to do a little pre-game research on the Wikipedia page or whatever to find out what the story's actually about, you know, that probably couldn't hurt either. Citizen 4.
I'm trying not to dominate you.
Thank you. That's much appreciated.
Your silence speaks volumes.
I was scolded by a listener.
Yes, and they were right.
I'm like a beaten animal now.
I was the beaten animal before because you were dominating me.
Well, but that's fun.
And then I had to set the bed on fire.
You're the Michael Vick. You're the person who's been punished for beating the lowly, stupid dog.
You hush. Citizen 4 is a new documentary from Laura Poitras, and it is pretty much the inside scoop about Edward Snowden. Like, she's the one who basically introduced him to Glenn Greenwald. Hmm. And you see all this happening on film. Like, that one picture of Edward Snowden that you always saw last fall when the story broke is basically a still from this movie.
Right.
And so she, you know, it took a while for them to kind of hook up because obviously Snowden was very cagey about who he was talking to. She was already on the sort of NSA watch list because her two previous films were critical of the war in Iraq and of Guantanamo Bay. But they managed to meet up in this hotel in Hong Kong, and she brings in Glenn Greenwald. And, you know, it's a very low-key, fly-on-the-wall kind of telling of this massive, you know, story where this guy who was a contractor for Booz Allen Hamilton, who had been loaned out to work for the government, leaked all these classified documents that were about the massive amounts of internal spying going on U.S. citizens and on, the ever-growing watch list of people, basically, via everything we do on our computers, on our cell phones. And, you know, it's quite chilling. And I think that it's easy to get wrapped up in the whole story of, like, whether or not what Snowden did was appropriate, whether it was ethical. That's not the story being told here. The story being told is, you're like, he's revealing this stuff, and, oh my God, this stuff that he is revealing is really terrifying. And you know, is anathema to what we're supposed to be as a free society. And frankly, you know, for I think how much Obama got elected in 2008 to sort of be the un-Bush, he has not really made big reversals in a lot of the areas that of things that Bush did that made people angry.
Yeah.
Like the Patriot Act, like Guantanamo Bay.
Right.
Like, you know, the sort of the level of transparency that he promised about, you know, things in the White House. So it's a fascinating film, and it's a terrifying film in a lot of ways, just in terms of, I mean, I was aware of the Snowden stuff, and I had been kind of following the story, but I had never really had it this laid out as to what he had to say and what the implications of it are and how far up the ladder it goes. I think it's a really compelling film.
I've heard an interview with her. I haven't seen the film. Mm-hmm. She's sympathetic to him. I mean, that is her
sure,
angle.
Yeah.
So I personally think he's a traitor. Across the board, I think he's a traitor. I mean,
well, where do you draw the line between traitor and whistleblower? I mean, I think a traitor is usually doing something to benefit some other foreign power or something, and I don't think that was the case here.
It did, though, benefit foreign powers because it let them know our process. And it wasn't just about what's happening in the United States. It was, you know, tons of documents sort of cataloging intelligence operations, you know, across the board, indiscriminately taken by him and semi-discriminately sort of handed over. Mm. And I don't believe in one person making our policy. And I don't think that is, you know, one citizen's... I mean,
I don't know that he's making it. I think he's exposing our
policy. But it's forming policy by the act of exposing it. And I think we're naive to think that hasn't been happening for decades, just in different forms. I mean, the technology is better now,
mm-hmm.
but if the American public thinks they haven't been being spied on their own land is for the last 100 years,
right,
they're naive.
But well, no, but you know what? It took activists along the way to establish things like the Freedom of Information Act, mm-hmm. you know, so that people could find out what was being done.
But the Freedom of Information Act isn't absolute because you still get redacted documents.
I know, but what I'm saying is that this stuff doesn't occur in a vacuum. The reason that we know what we know is because people like this went public and made a thing about it. And I think him going public isn't one man making policy, it's one man revealing policy, which then leaves it to the public and the government to react however they're going to react.
Mm. I Yeah, I will agree to disagree.
Very well.
Remain friends. I just don't think he's as smart as he thinks he is, and I don't think he went about it in a way that truly did any good, except now we know. You know what I mean? Like, what good has it done?
Well, I think the good it would do would be if people were more revved up about it. I think too many people are sort of cynical and blasé about it. And I sense a general, I'm not saying you, I'm saying there's a defeatist attitude of, what are you going to do? And I think that's an attitude that has been ingrained into us over the last several decades. Mm. I mean, the conservative movement in this country, for the most part, has been, how do we keep the 1960s from ever happening again? Like, let's make it really expensive for people to go to college.
Right.
Let's not educate people in general. You know, let's
have protest zones.
The free speech zones, right, which is one of the great Orwellian expressions of all time. Let's, you know, slash the minimum wage. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of feel like we are turned into this populace of people who, as long as we have our satellite dish, you know, that we're just not going to care about this stuff. And I feel like this stuff's still important. And, you know, unfortunately, these kind of revelations happen when one person does something that may or may not have been in everyone's best interest and maybe could have been handled better, mm-hmm. you know, and we can then spend the rest of our lives nitpicking the methodology by which the information became public and then gloss over the larger, much larger implications of that information and what it says about how the world works right now.
I think that I'm one of those people that has the attitude you were describing, and I don't take offense at that, because I do have the attitude of, well, that's the way it is. And I feel like, personally, I have, you know, nothing to lose by them monitoring my phone calls. I have nothing to lose. So, I'm a little, I guess, nonplussed by the... Because I think it's telling that there are some people like me that are like, eh. And there's other people that are like, how dare they? Which means that there's enough on either side of this story that maybe nobody's completely right, or maybe it's not the huge crime that we're accusing the government of, but maybe it's also not so harmless as many people like me think it is.
I don't know. I feel like we have been conditioned, and I'm not chained to anything right now.
I'm also a Democrat, by the way. I feel like I need to make that clear.
Sure, no, of course.
Nonplussed means that you're surprised.
Ugh, look, Conan the Grammarian, I don't need you redlining my effing podcast chit-chat.
Are y'all done?
No, hang on. I have one last point I was trying to make. I mean, it's not like I'm out there chained to anything, and I'm not as politically active as I could be, but I feel like we shrug our shoulders too often about stuff as it just gets slowly, incrementally gets worse and worse. You know, we find out that we're, you know, torturing political prisoners or something. It's like, you know, and after a while it becomes like, well, what is our notion of America, of, you know, this, oh, we're supposed to
be...
Do
you have the Star Spangled Banner?
We're supposed to be this, we're this bastion of freedom and democracy. We're supposed to be setting this example to the rest of the world. And every so often, it just turns out, no, we're doing a really crappy job of it. And so, you know, I don't know. I don't even know what my end point here is.
Sausages taste great, but they are made in a certain way, and that's not going to change.
I suppose. Anyway, go see Citizen Four.
I've not yet seen this film.
Mm.
But I do plan to see this film.
Oh, great.
As our listener who hates me pointed out. But here's what I know already. I will disagree with Sean Abley.
Surprise.
Just because it's Sean Abley.
Yes.
All right, so that's it. Those are our movies this week.
That's it. What are your DVD recommendations?
Mine is a new gorgeous box from the Criterion Collection, the Jacques Tati Collection.
Jacques Tati or Jacques Demy?
Jacques Tati.
Okay.
The Demy one already came out.
Yeah.
This one is the complete filmography of Jacques Tati.
Boom.
All the shorts, you know, everything from...
But you don't want to watch Playtime on a TV.
No, you don't. But everything else from Jour
de Fête. You might have to.
Jour de Fête
if you don't live in a city such as the beautiful Los Angeles.
Yes, where you can see it in 70mm every
Pretty
so
much
often.
Once a year they show it here.
No, it's so good.
If you can see it on the most ginormous television you can, that would help maybe.
And they only release... in the theaters, the uncut version, right? They're not still sending out the cut version of that film.
Right.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Okay. And certainly if you're seeing it in 70, you're seeing the full thing. Anyway, so, and, you know, it being Criterion, there's tons of extras, and Yeah, he is one of my favorite filmmakers, and I'm very excited that this the collection is out. Sean?
Yeah.
Well, one of the reasons why I forced you to, like I said, to be on the podcast is because I thought there's going to be Halloween movies. So I'll recommend a Halloween movie, Martyrs, which came out in, I believe, I'm looking at my phone here, 2008, something like that, which is this amazingly awesome French horror movie that is not the movie you think it is when you start watching it. And then it's not the movie you think it is when you get two-thirds of the way through it either. It's such a twisty, weird, three different films, almost three different genres of a film that I don't know how it ever got made. But it's sort of being held as the gold standard these days of horror movies. And he also made a follow-up with Jessica Biel, an English-language film called The Tall Man, which, not to be confused with Angus Grimm from the Phantasm movies, which is also... she's really great in it, and
really?
It's about a community where this tall man is kidnapping all the children, and they disappear. And, again, it's not the movie you think it is, and I don't want to spoil the twist, because they're really good.
Turns out he's short.
Exactly. He's wearing stilts, and he's from the Cirque du Soleil. Tell me again how you say his last name, because you're literally the only person who's ever said his last name out loud.
Here, hand me the phone.
Pascal Laugier? Is that what we said?
Let me see.
Oh my gosh. My horror fans.
Laugier.
Laugier.
Yeah.
Is the guy who made these movies, and I heartily recommend them.
Martyrs. Okay, cool. Thank you. Yes. Dave?
Black Sabbath.
The Mario Bava?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I like the telephone part with the lady on the telephone.
All
right. I like the part where the guy... Boris Karloff.
The guy. Yeah.
That one dude.
He was in that movie?
Yeah. Tells his family he's killed the Wordulac. Or Wordulac, or whatever you call it. I like that part.
Am I mixing this up with Black Sunday?
Black Sunday is the one with the blimp and the Super Bowl.
And yeah. Barbara Steele. No, Barbara Steele.
Barbara Steele's in Black Sabbath.
Black Sabbath, yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. The face, the mask at the beginning. I can't believe you don't love that part.
I do.
Okay.
He just didn't mention it.
All right. Sorry.
I was waiting for you to jump in.
Sorry. Don't give them 3 stars because I'm talking over them.
Letters?
Okay. We got one and then we're done.
Okay.
Because I got to make dinner. I'm hungry and y'all talked a long time. This is from... Wait. Who was this from? Before I need to say who it's from first. It's from Tim from Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to have to help me remember what I said.
Okay.
As one of your senior listeners, let me tell you boys something.
Oh, no, I remember exactly what this is about. When we were talking about Pride...
Hang on, I'm going to read the letter.
I know, but let me give some warm-up as to what he's referring to.
All right.
When we were talking about Pride, there's one character in the film played by Dominic West who's very sort of flamboyant, and there's other gay characters in the film who are sort of put off by that and sort of embarrassed and want him to tamp it down. And you went off on this thing about... self-hating gays basically are the ones who want to tamp down the queenie ones.
Dominic West from The Wire?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
And The Affair. So, go on.
He says, let me tell you boys something. I'm fixing to get told something.
Mm.
Remember the time and place that Pride is set before assuming that self-loathing makes people extra careful before assuming that self-loathing makes people extra careful about appearing too gay, in quotes. Until only very recently, being flamboyant in public could make life hell for you. In the midst of the AIDS plague, it was second nature for gay people to be careful, to watch over their shoulder, to not let strangers get too close. Political activists were caught in a double bind. You want to declare your real identity, but if you were perceived as gay to any degree, you and everything you said were immediately dismissed. In 1964, Frank Kameny. Insisted that protesters at the first marches in Philadelphia wear business attire. I knew about that. Mm. Suits and ties for the men, skirts and dresses for the women, for that very reason. No matter how scary you guys imagine the 50s and 60s to have been for gay people, trust me, it was 20 times worse. So after that screed, I should probably add a top 10 list of most depressing movies ever. But Woody Allen's Interiors is on, and I need a good laugh. Keep up the good work. Tim from Baltimore.
Thank you, Tim.
So I'm sure I did say that, but it isn't exactly what I meant.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I was in the 80s, so I remember them, and there was a reason I did not come out until 1980. 89, and then also in two people in 1992. Like, I had 3 whole years of me just saying myself to myself, I guess I'm gay. Before I ever told a single person. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, the 80s were so gross that I stayed in the closet all through the 80s and didn't want anything to do with myself or anything else that was gay. So it was horrible in the 80s. Even though the 70s were this time of explosion of gay visibility, it was still horrible. And AIDS made it horrible, and just people made it horrible. So, I remember the 80s, and I remember they were gross and bad. And I wouldn't have called myself self-loathing back then. I would just have called myself young and terrified. And so... I get it. In the 50s and 60s, I can't even imagine. Like, I was born in 1964, but I cannot imagine the pressure of that. And so I do not believe that people who policed themselves strictly back then were self-loathing. They were just looking out for their own lives. Mm-hmm. I get that. So whatever I said was just me being stupid and off the cuff. Also... I love that you said that we were boys because I just turned 50. And,
Snapper.
Yeah.
All right.
I like being the youthful one in the room.
Yes. Dewy, fresh, fun. Yeah. All right. We got to wrap up. Sean, where can people find you online?
SeanAbley.com or my Gay of the Dead blog on Fangoria.com.
And are you on Twitter?
I'm on Twitter. Gay of the Dead is my Twitter handle. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think you can just search my name as well. And I'm on the Facebooks just under my real name.
Awesome. I will spare you the long list of podcasts this week because we got to run. But we do want to thank Blue for our awesome theme music. You can subscribe to the show for free on iTunes. And you can leave us a review, as did the wonderful... PC Devitt, Christopher 575, Sean, not you,
not me.
And Sacramento Movie Bear. We appreciate the nice reviews, especially since they help push down that 3-star one that bugs Dave so much. You can stream the show.
It's not the 3 stars that bugs me.
It's why.
It's why. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's getting schooled.
I'm gonna be better.
Okay.
I'm changing.
Yeah, you can stream the show for free at Stitcher Radio or TheLounge.com or on our Facebook page. And if you have not liked the Linoleum Knife podcast page on Facebook,
yeah, go
please,
do that.
Please go do it. That would please be an awesome thing. That. It's a good thing for the show.
Yes, it is.
You can follow us on Twitter at LinoleumCast. You can check into the show at TVTag.com. Drop us a line at LinoleumPodcast@gmail.com. That's also the PayPal address to use if you want to buy one of our Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife episodes. Those are $1.99 each. Just include your email address. We are about to record our latest one for the Poseidon Adventure. That'll be coming up in the next week or two.
Any second now.
You can also PayPal us $20 for one of our glamorous Linoleum Knife t-shirts designed by Graham Colbeans. Not for opening ceremony. Just let us know.
Everything else is for opening ceremony.
Yeah.
Linoleum Knife t-shirts are not for
opening. We got them on ceremony. The side. Yeah. So that's $20 within the United States. Include your t-shirt size for a Hanes BFT 100% cotton and your shipping address. And happy Halloween. We will catch you next week.
Goodbye.